This is Deanna Spingola. It is Thursday, September 6, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Vicki Davis. Her website is channelingreality.com. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Deanna. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. So you recently wrote an article, The Marshall Plan for Latin America. And of course, that's all part of Agenda 21, correct?
Well, it's all part of a continuing process of internationalization and cannibalizing of our nation, you know, the United States. Cannibalizing it, replacing what we had with an international system.
Okay. Well, yes, and of course, this has been in operation for some time. Didn't it kind of start with NAFTA and some of the trade agreements?
Actually, no, it started much before that. It actually started around the turn of the century with the creation of international organizations. And after World War One, you know, end of World War One, the Versailles Treaty, of course, created the League of Nations, and that was the first attempt at a global, international governing structure. But it wasn't really designed to be a governing structure per se. And that was then followed, of course, by World War II and the creation of the United Nations, which was really a more of what they considered to be a governing structure through non-governmental organizations and associations. The United Nations itself is an association.
Right. Well, the League of Nations, the U.S. didn't ever sign it. Congress didn't ratify it. And so that's probably why it didn't work. Or, as you say, it would have been much earlier that they would have been more successful with this.
Yeah, that's my understanding. Even though Roosevelt, or not Roosevelt, but Woodrow Wilson was behind it, but the Senate wouldn't ratify it. And apparently it also did not have any teeth to it. There was no way to make the other nations, our nation, any nation, fall into line with the decisions of the League of Nations. So whatever problems there were with the League of Nations, they attempted to correct with the United Nations.
Right. And of course, now they have more of an enforcement since they've got NATO and the military force, which of course is the United States.
Uh-huh. Yeah, NATO and the United States, which I guess NATO really is the United States for the most part. But I'm not even really sure of that now, with the way that things are going. I mean, because it doesn't really make sense that you would suicide your own nation, which is what is happening to our country, you know, unless these so-called wise men who have been working on this plan for all of this time are just so egotistical that they think they can control the whole world without the United States. You know, I really don't
right.
know.
And I think, too, that after World War II, all of this seemed to happen after World War II and as a result of World War II. But then you also had the secretive CIA who was going all over the world, or well, particularly in South and Central America, doing all kinds of awful things and toppling governments and assassinating people that they didn't like. So they probably had to kind of remake the foundation and the governments of other countries so they would go along with the whole thing.
Well, and that was the idea. With our post-war planning for Europe, the Marshall Plan was designed, I mean, the whole idea was to create a United States of Europe.
Right.
And ultimately, you know, it became to be called the European Union. But the our whole national security state, our government was redesigned in 1947. And the intent of it really was to establish the kind of organization that was worked behind the curtain to carry out the mission of basically subverting European national sovereignty of the, you know, the nation states of the Western European countries in order to create the European Union.
Right.
So it was that was the design. It was covert, and that was the purpose of it.
Right. Now, this was named after George C. Marshall, who was a Freemason and a Pilgrim Society member. And he was also the Secretary of State. Apparently, that's why they named it after that, after him, right?
Yeah, he gave a speech at Harvard laying out the plan. Now, the way that the history reads, apparently there were two plans. There was the Morgenthau plan that was supposedly written by Harry Dexter White,
mm-hmm.
who was in the State Department. And that plan was to completely deindustrialize Germany, to turn it into basically an agricultural area so that Germany could never rise again. Well, apparently Hoover was sent over to Europe to review the plan and see how that would work out. And he determined that about 25 million people would have to die to do that because there just simply would not be enough work or enough productivity to support the population. So instead of the Morgenthau plan, they went with the Marshall Plan, which was a program of both lending and also supplying the technical expertise and making money at the same time while American businesses sold to Europe so that they could rebuild their economy.
Right. And the U.S. government made it sound all very altruistic and, you know, they were going to rebuild devastated Europe. But as you say, the people could only spend the money with particular companies. And so it's like, okay, we're going to go over there and we're going to devastate these countries and then we're going to offer them money with high interest rates and then tell them the companies that they could use to rebuild.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything has been done in the name of humanitarianism, but there's nothing humanitarian about it. It's all about the money.
Right.
And I forget what year it was, but at some point, a few years after the end of the war, when they started the Marshall Plan, Secretary of State Dean Acheson, I think he was Secretary of State at that point,
right,
said that what they needed to do was to, in order to continue helping Europe in the progress towards rebuilding Europe, what we needed to do at that point was to begin massively importing into this country so that the European country, the European Union, they weren't the Union then, but so that they would have a market for their goods, you know, to give them enough capital to then really become independent. And so that's really when the U.S. trade deficit started.
Hmm. Now, Acheson was also a member of the CFR, and he was also a Pilgrim Society member. And he was undersecretary to Marshall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, isn't it interesting how it always seems to go back to Great Britain, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. Indeed.
Yeah. So anyway, about somewhere in the late 1950s, when they could no longer really justify helping Europe anymore, that they then shifted their focus towards Latin America. And it wasn't just Kennedy. It started under the Eisenhower administration. And an Inter-American Development Bank was set up during his administration. But when Kennedy was elected, one of his programs was called the Alliance for Progress, which was a Marshall Plan for Latin America. And so, and the intent is, well, okay, going back to about the, 1826, the idea of Simón Bolívar was also to create a union, a customs union of Latin American countries. And then around the turn of the century, there was a big conference. And let me find it here. I think it was 1899 or something like that.
Yeah, a lot of things happened from 1897 on. It's amazing how many things happened at that period of time.
Well, yeah, and I think they were all looking at a point in time when there would need to be some kind of world system of some kind, you know, to for the nations to negotiate, because it was at that point that they realized that I don't think there were really any more unexplored frontiers in the world, except perhaps for Antarctica and the North Pole. But for the most part, the world was fully explored. And so I think they were looking towards a time, you know, when there would be this, the need for something at a global level. Because that's when all this activity really started. Okay, but the first conference of the American Republics was held in 1889. I was wrong about that year. And then in 1900, they established a Commercial Bureau of American Republics in Washington. And out of that came essentially the idea for Pan-America, which is what you could say is the same plan, same strategy as for Europe, you know, to create a free trade area of the Americas, again, on humanitarian grounds. Latin America was supposedly underdeveloped, and so, you know, they wanted to be able to trade across national borders. And so that was the whole thing. But the Organization of American States was created in 1948, and it was created as a regional organization under the United Nations. So, I mean, it's like, you know, history repeating itself all over again.
Right. And again, when you think of the CIA... they developed it to perpetuate American business interest, which is what they were planning their whole one world government around, is the ability to do business all over the world and be multinational corporations. And in order to do that, those governments had to give up their sovereignty and totally rely on. Well, not rely on, but totally go with the UN. And if they didn't, then the CIA would do a few assassinations. I think that in 1 year alone, on the A list of assassinations, there were 58 names. it just in Guatemala that they had to get rid of all these people.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that really is the way that this whole thing works. They talk humanitarianism, but it's really about exploitation. And the other countries, the so-called developing countries, have to Basically, now this is the way it was. Of course, now things have been reversed, but back then, the idea was that the Latin American countries would sell into the United States. And it's through these development organizations. The development organizations go down there supposedly to provide development money. But what it really looks like to me is that the development money is really nothing more than bribe money, you know, for the elite of an area, whatever area it is that they're working on. And the elite make lots of money. The people stay poor. And then everybody is cooperative in the humanitarian message.
Right. Sure. They all have the same cover story. And the people that don't, they claim that they're communists and they have to be eliminated.
Right, and that's what I wrote on the top of this that I wrote, and it just came to me that this is the truth of it. Communists are what they call their rivals. Economic developers are what they call their allies, but they are one and the same in practice.
Right.
And so what my research has tried to do is it's really more of a history of central planning and the use of computers. But it's taken me throughout, you know, back into history and then back again. But all of this is strategically planned. And we here in the United States, you know, we were taught that central planning is really a bad thing, doesn't work. Well, they've made it work all over the world, and whether it works or not depends on your point of view.
Right.
For the global elite, it works out really, really well.
Sure does. And of course, they control the media, and they control all of the perception management apparatuses, and so the Americans are just thinking, oh, gosh, you know, we do so much for so many people, so many countries, and they certainly don't appreciate us at all. Look at how they respond.
Yeah, to our humanitarianism.
Right, well, killing all their leaders and whatnot.
Yeah, well, okay, but if we go back to the Marshall Plan, you can see where the central planning agencies were set up. They started out with the U.S. Economic Cooperation Administration, and a European counterpart was set up, the Organization for European Economic Cooperation. The acronym on that is the OEEC. Well, around in the 1960s, you know, when they had finished their mission over in Europe and they were planning on focusing on Latin America, they remissioned the OEEC to be the OECD, which is the Organization for Economic
Cooperation.
Development. Yeah, cooperation, something like that.
Yeah, the Organization for European Economic Cooperation. Mm-hmm. And later they call it the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development.
Well, they added the development part of it. I think that was Kennedy's request that they do that because he planned on using the OECD in cooperation to work on the Latin American common market, which is what they were calling it at the time. And the people in the United States were told that it really was only for Latin America. You know, here we're being humanitarian and we're helping them to create their common market.
Mm-hmm. Now, wasn't this kind of a Rockefeller plan to begin with over in Europe, and isn't it also a Rockefeller plan in South America?
Yes, Rockefeller was involved in it. I'm not sure whether he initiated it, or whether it was somebody like Jacob Javits, who
for South America, or
yeah, for well, for the whole thing. I mean, the whole program. Jacob Javits was a senator in New York, and he was fully behind this plan to help Latin Americans create their common market. And he was supported by David Rockefeller, but, you know, who initiated it, I don't know. It could very well have been Rockefeller.
I know that for Europe, I think it was Winthrop Aldrich was the one that tried it, that pushed it through, heard it through Congress, and he was the president of Chase Manhattan Bank, and Nelson Rockefeller's brother-in-law. So apparently, but that was for Europe, and Senator Joseph McCarthy was quite active during that period of time. And he referred to this whole thing as a living lie.
The whole development of Europe, the development of Latin America?
The Marshall Plan for Europe.
Yes. Well, and it was because the way that it was presented to the people of the United States, we were helping the European countries. I don't think if the State Department or the President had announced the plan is really to subvert the European governments in order to create a European Union. I don't think the American people would have gone for that, and I'm sure that the people in Europe would not have gone for that.
Right. Now, was it also a way of redistributing America's wealth overseas?
Well, yeah, it does, because as it turns out, it works out to be an extraction method. And where the American wealth, American resources, and American know-how is extracted, and we're building up our alleged competitors. Well, it's not really competition if the coach is helping the other team, you know?
Right.
So, and when they started in with the Latin American development, it did in fact become an extraction method, because that's really when they started using trade agreements. And going back to what Secretary of State Dean Acheson said, okay, now what we have to do is start importing European products into our country to help them build their industries. Well, they did the same thing down in Latin America, and they gave them trade preferences because supposedly they're a developing country, right? So they get trade preferences importing into our country.
The things that we could create ourselves.
Yeah, we didn't need
their stuff.
We didn't need their stuff. We didn't need their know-how. We didn't need anything. Today is the same thing. We don't need China. We don't need their stuff. We don't need their know-how. We don't need India. You know, but they what they've done is they've turned the United States into the essentially the market for the world, you know, all importing, building up our trade deficit, and building up our domestic deficit, because every time they sign one of these trade agreements, for all this time, these trade agreements have been trading away American production.
Right, and sending our money out of the country to enhance another economy, the economy of other countries.
Yeah. And so, you know, when they talk about competition and stuff, I mean, it's just the biggest lie. Well, I guess their theory is that if they give another country the know-how like they gave China, or automobile business, the manufacturing of automobiles, then somehow, you know, we're going to compete with this 50 cent an hour labor.
Right.
And it's just, it's absurd. But where they really messed up is that they then started outsourcing IT. IT is the intellectual work, you know, service jobs. They started exporting those over to India. Well, what's left? There's really nothing left. If you send off your production and then you send off the administrative work that goes with it, then what you're left with is simply the sales office.
Right.
And since, you know, imports can come into this country for free because of this trade policy that supposedly is supposed to help developing countries develop, then there really is nothing left for the United States.
Right.
Now, there's a whole design of a system that I call the Trojan Triangle system that is supposed to be the economy of the future, you know, where the ideas and the research and development is done through the universities, and they will commercialize products. And then I suppose they go offshore to be manufactured in some other country, China or India or whatever. But, I mean, there are so many flaws in that idea. I could spend a whole 2 hours talking about that. But, you know, just to make it brief, there's not that many people that can participate in that kind of an economy.
Oh, of course not.
It's not an economy. I mean, that is not an economy. That is a system of privilege for a few.
Right. Well, I think it also, with the Marshall Plan and with what we're doing in every other country, and also having military bases in what, 700 places? We have 700 military bases all over, and that is to protect those things that the elite are doing, the so-called elite are doing. But the thing that is so egregious in this situation with the Marshall Plan is that it shifts the burden of everything to the taxpayer, while the corporations enhance their profits, and the president and Congress, because of their acquiescence to all of these plans, then become popular with the corporations. And of course, we think, or we thought, that we were giving funds to disseminate the communist boogeyman, but it really our taxpayer dollars has been used to enhance the compliant leaders of other countries. I mean, it's just a ripoff, a total ripoff.
Yeah, it is. It's just the biggest scam in the entire world, and that's. I started this, you know, research because of outsourcing, because it makes no sense whatsoever to export IT jobs, because it, you know, those were our best middle class jobs, engineering and IT and software, and you know, those were our best middle class jobs.
Right.
And where you go from there, there's nowhere to go. I mean, you know, that's like lemmings moving off a cliff in terms of our economy. And so I started with that research, and then I found out about the trade agreements. Well, these trade agreements, they were never negotiated in the interest of the American people. They were negotiated, quote, to open markets, supposedly. But those trade agreements call for the free movement of people and goods. Okay, so it's not just products that are going to be free to move across the border. It's people.
Right. And that is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I for the life of me, I can't figure out why they thought that there could be free movement of people without the entire world's poor population descending upon the United States. And so, from 2000, well, I'm not sure exactly when it started, but Mexico, people in Mexico thought they were going to move in
Right.
to our country, just wide open border. And the wide open border was, of course, the free movement of people.
Right. And
And
that was formalized with the treaty that they signed when in March of 2005, Bush and the President of Canada and the President of Mexico got together and signed the North American Community Treaty.
well,
And that's a de facto getting rid of the borders.
well, actually, when they signed the WTO agreement, that basically did it, NAFTA and the WTO. But the thing was, is that what people needed to say when they walked across the border was to say that I am a service provider under the World Trade Organization. And so, when you look at the World Trade Organization, there are the agreement covers four modes of services. Doing a service here in this country. I forget what all the four modes are, but essentially, if you're providing a service in a commercial sense, then you can come into the country to do that. Under the World Trade Agreement
Right.
Organization treaty.
And it's very interesting that after the Vietnam War, that they put sanctions and embargo on Vietnam until they agreed to join the World Trade Organization.
Yeah, everybody has to join into the World Trade Organization, but only the multinational corporations really profit from it.
Right.
I mean, and they profit big time. But all over the world, the working people, they've been displaced by what do they call it, a diaspora, where you
Diaspora,
have
yeah.
diaspora, massive numbers of people moving from one country to another. But they're really chasing prosperity, because there really is no prosperity because of the way that the global economy has been structured.
Right. And of course we see in the campaign promises of the Democrats and the Republicans, they're both promising that they're going to create jobs. How in heaven's name can the American public swallow this garbage that they think that the government can create jobs?
I don't know, just the when the politicians say the government creating jobs, I mean, that just screams at me.
It
But
does.
then,
It's ridiculous.
yeah, but I, of course, grew up in the era of the communist boogeyman, and if somebody would have said government creating jobs, back in the 1960s or 70s, people would have gone nuts. Communist, communist. But what I've come to realize, and I'm sure you've seen Pat Wood's videos on
Oh,
technocracy.
I have, yes.
Yeah, I think that academics have done a real disservice to the people of the world by calling these central planners communists in a political context, because I don't think it belongs in a political context. What this is systems engineering, and they use the marketing rhetoric. But when you strip away the marketing rhetoric, like humanitarianism or like economic growth or whatever it is, strip that away, and what you're left with is just systems engineering. And
Right.
You have people in the world who want to design systems, and supposedly it will make everything good. The problem is, of course, that when you're designing systems like for an economy, not all people are created equal. Not all levels of development are equal. And so you can't, it doesn't really work, and it can't work, in any way that the ordinary person would buy off on if they understood it.
Right. Now you mentioned Jacob Javits. And if I recall correctly, he worked for Ted Kennedy during the 60s when Ted Kennedy was behind the changing of the immigration laws in about 1965.
Well, you know more about that than I do, but it wouldn't surprise me at all. Jacob Javits was supposedly a Republican, but the truth is there are no real Republicans in New York, in the New York City area. They just used the Republican Party so you could have two Democrats running against each other. So, it wouldn't surprise me at all if he did that.
Yeah, seems to me that that's what happened.
Well, Jacob Javits was really a big push behind this Marshall Plan for Latin America. And he came up with a plan. Jacob Javits and Senator Hubert Humphrey, I have a quote here. It says, they initiated a bipartisan effort to promote and secure investment of European capital in Latin America by creating a private nonprofit organization called the Atlantic Community Development Group for Latin America. And the acronym on that is ADELA. And that, when I saw, well, I already knew about ADELA when I was studying Aurelio Peccei, Peccei, who was one of the founders of the Club of Rome. And I'm not sure, but that might have been what got me started on this line of research, because I needed to know what the acronym was for ADELA. And so and I found out that it was really Jacob Javits who was the big push behind setting it up. And ADELA, their objective was to essentially direct the development dollars down in Latin America. And Aurelio Peccei, he was had been in Latin America for a long time. He was an Italian. He worked for Fiat, and he helped rebuild Fiat manufacturing in Argentina following World War II. And I'm not sure about this. He belonged to an organization during the war called, I don't know what the name of that was, but I think he was a communist. Oh, Giustizia e Libertà. I'm sure I just destroyed that. But anyway, the Club of Rome, as everybody probably knows by now, they were one of the big organizations behind a move towards environmentalism. And well, Peccei was a humanist, and so there you go with your humanitarianism, but really the
Right.
objective was to prevent development, at least
Right.
in this country. And well, he was the Club of Rome commissioned the report that led to the book Limits to Growth. And that, I didn't realize the power that was behind Peccei, but that book was presented at the Smithsonian, And of course, now, we know that Rockefeller was behind it, and these powerful senators were behind the idea of development in Latin America. But what they said is there are limits to growth. But what they were doing is looking at the United States and our standard of living and saying, no, we can't continue this kind of growth. We've got to balance things out. So we have to develop the underdeveloped countries as we tamp down our development to
Right.
make everything kind of just equal. I really think these people have an obsession with balance. It's
Well, they want to make everyone equal so that they can decrease everybody's status to slavery.
yes. And that is the what the ultimate outcome of this technocratic system will be. And it's that was another eye-opener for me, is the institutionalized treachery is the only way that I can really describe it. But the duality of the message, if you once you understand the duality of their messages, where they say they're doing things for a humanitarian purpose, and then you look at the reality of what they've done and what their intent was, and it's quite the opposite. Well, that kind of duplicity has been institutionalized in the United States, and I think our whole education system is designed to stunt the growth of children, the American children, and future generations in this pursuit for equal poverty and slavery for all.
Yes. Getting back to Dean Acheson, he is the one that Roosevelt had assigned Morgenthau and Acheson to study trade opportunities between the Soviets and the U.S., and it was Acheson that convinced Roosevelt initially to recognize the Soviet Union. When he, within a short period of time, on November 16th, 1933, and Acheson and Henry Morgenthau were both proteges of Felix Frankfurter, the Supreme Court judge.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, I haven't. That's a research area that I haven't gotten into, but all of this revolves around trade. I mean, it seems like it started with trade. It has always been about trade. And of course, the even around 1913, or I guess it was. Was it 1913 when they passed
Federal
the
Reserve
income?
Act.
Well, it was the Federal Reserve Act, but there was another act that went along with it, and it had to do with opening up our country for trade to allow imports into our country and to make up for the lost revenue on tariffs. They applied an income tax on the American people that was ultimately declared to be unconstitutional.
Yeah, it was
And that
it was declared unconstitutional in 1894 by the court, and then they said they with the 16th Amendment, which was never actually ratified by the appropriate number of states, if any, and nobody actually paid income tax until they started propagating through the movies, particularly through Disney. That we all needed to pay our fair share.
Yeah, and the reason we did is because they lowered the tariffs to allow imports.
Right.
And progressively over time, was initially the only power that the president had was to negotiate the price of the tariff. At around in what was it nine it was 1979 or 1974, I forget which. The Congress voted to allow the president to negotiate more than just tariffs. And then, as each one of these trade rounds has occurred, they've given the president more and more leeway until basically the president and the U.S. trade representative negotiated agreements to just trade away entire sectors of our economy.
Right. And of course, this whole tariff thing started with McKinley's Tariff Act of 1890. And this had to do with getting sugar duty free. And it was because of the monopoly that the Sugar Trust had and their influence with the U.S. Congress. And so after that monopoly got started, then you had so many monopolies. You had the oil monopoly and the And they just sucked up all of their competitors, whether we're talking about sugar or oil or whatever.
Or milk.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Well, and that's essentially what's happening now, the same thing, except that they, rather than setting up the monopolies through one corporation, they've set it up in such a way that there is an association that is the monopoly. That's what they're really calling the market. It's a middleman kind of strategy
Right.
that really hides the fact that what you actually have is a horizontal and a vertical monopoly.
Right. And the middleman, that middleman that you're talking about, makes a lot of the money. And the farmers, if we're talking about produce, they don't make it at all.
Right, they make no, yeah, the producers and the consumers both get hurt in the middleman strategy. It's an artificial creation. If
Right.
you think about the what computers did is that it enabled the elimination of the middleman. Well, what they're doing now is they are artificially putting the middleman back. And it becomes the monopoly. But people aren't used to thinking about monopolies in terms of a middleman. They're used to looking at one corporation like AT&T and saying, well, that's a monopoly.
Right.
So it's kind of a stealth kind of strategy in a way. And because of computers and the way that they can link together and coordinate their activities with no visible signs of communications, corporations can have their monopoly structures with the supply chain, but it's really this trading central trading middleman that is the controller of the monopoly overall.
Right.
Okay, like the oil monopoly. There really is a central repository or a central trading system for oil and oil futures and all of that. And of course, they're the ones that are really driving up the price.
Sure.
Because when you have a monopoly, a market monopoly, naturally, the future is pretty grim.
Right, and the monopoly sets a price on whatever product they happen to be monopolizing. The same in the medical industry. You have an AMA monopoly, and you were talking about the computers. You could, have this big database and connect everything together without there seeming, to be a connection. And I think that if people were to go to their doctor, they would have to be filling out these forms so that they could get all their information into the new up-and-coming computer database that I think is nationwide.
It is, and it was always intended to be. In 1990, you see, it was actually the George Herbert Walker Bush administration that started the project for healthcare redesign.
Ah.
And in 1990, was Senator John Glenn. He was the chairman of the Government Reform Committee, or I'm not sure which committee. But anyway, he wrote a letter to the Congressional Research Service, I think, asking them to do, or maybe it was the GSA, asking them anyway to do a study on what would be the benefits to a national medical records database. And initially, it was just going to be Medicare, of course, but the way this whole internet has rolled out, it really was a national database of medical records. And just strictly from a dollars and cents standpoint, from the public's point of view, there is no benefit, for the public. It is a cost, it's an overhead. And it is a classic example of the socialization of costs and the privatization of profits.
Right. Right.
So the public picks up the tab for the maintenance of medical records, and all organizations that have an interest in those medical records then get a free ride on it.
Of course, like the pharmaceutical companies and
The big hospital corporations, I mean,
yes.
you know.
And I think a lot of doctors are now combining with the hospitals that they may work in, combining with the hospitals as part of the hospital team in a more
Well,
direct way.
they have to, because otherwise they will be squeezed out of business. The idea is to have team medicine, as if you need to have a team of doctors, diagnose you, rather than just, a personal interaction between you and your doctor. But I think there are two reasons for that. First of all, they're kind of giving doctors a golden parachute out of the system. They're basically paying them to not really be doctors, but to just be consultants. And secondly, the idea ultimately is to replace doctors with nurse practitioners and physicians' assistants. And from all of my research on the healthcare system, the reason for that is because the plan is to have computer-aided assistance for diagnosis and prescribing. And really, it's part of the continuation of the Human Genome Project. Now, if you have a fully trained doctor, the doctor is going to do his own thinking on what medications to prescribe or what the diagnosis is. So they need lesser qualified people who are dependent on the computer system in order to develop the computer system. But what that really means is that they will be experimenting on people, a lifetime human experimentation.
You mean more than they are now?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And of course, the Medicare Foundation was basically a foundation that was set up to drive everybody into that organization. Or
Yeah.
into that framework.
Well, okay, think about it from the point of view of a medical researcher. Say you're a genetics medical researcher. Now, wouldn't you just be salivating at the opportunity to be able to look at a database of medical records for the entire population? And plus, you know, when you look at total information awareness, you can get the whole of the demographic information about that person. I mean, it's a researcher's dream.
Oh, wow.
And the way that the way they've designed this system, with the second tier providers being the front end, you know, the nurse practitioners and the physician's assistants. Well, you know, I'm sorry, though, they're not doctors, and they are little more than the school nurse. Okay, so they will have to rely on the computer system, you know, to help them with the diagnosis and to help them with the what to prescribe. Well, all since they have your medical record, they will also have your lab results, your blood chemistry, everything else. Ultimately, what the computer system will do is an analysis on your blood chemistry and on all of the information that they have, and the computer will say precisely what medication to give to you. It won't be a generic one size fits all medicine. It will be personalized, a you know, personalized medication. So they will have compounding pharmacies all over the country, and those compounding pharmacies will be the ones they will formulate customized medicine. Well, here again, that is human experimentation.
Right. And you have Walgreens, they're popping up all over on every corner in the area where I live, and you think, wow, something's going on here. Why do we need all of these drugstores? And so I think that Obamacare will implement some sort of a, well, we know that it's probably designed to help with the depopulation program, and it's certainly designed to get everybody into the government records so that they can take control of our whole body. I mean, that's our last, that's our private property in the most intimate way. And it's also, of course, about the insurance scam.
Well, yeah, all the while they're experimenting on you, they will, you know, be taking your money to take care of you. And the thing is that unless they can experiment on populations of people, and the people won't even know it. And because they have all of the medical records, they can distribute the test subjects in such a way that you don't have clusters of people dying. Because they get some medication, you know, they can be distributed around the country. I mean, they have the whole country to choose their test subject populations.
Right.
It's really frightening. I mean, the more you understand about it, the more frightening it gets, what the potential is for what they can do, and what I know that they plan to do. Because I, you know, when I was researching this, I listened to these, you know, forums of people as they were talking about what could be done and should it be done, the ethical considerations of doing different things. And so, I mean, you could, even though nobody ever said, yeah, we're going to experiment on all these people, it was implicit and they all knew it. And if you were at all familiar with the subject, you would know it too.
Right.
So.
And of course, well, this week has been Vaccine Awareness Week on my radio program. And oh my goodness, they've been experimenting on us for a long time. I think they're just going to ramp it up.
Oh, yeah, I do too. I do too. Did you know that there was a plan to have clinics in the Walmarts?
No. You know, I never go into a Walmart store because I saw Walmart come in and destroy so many independent family-owned businesses during the time that I was traveling in my five Midwest states when I was in the textile industry. And there were all kinds of little shops and stores that I used to call on, and they just started disappearing left and right. And because Walmarts were going in all over, particularly in southern Illinois and, in Iowa and Wisconsin. And so I really don't go into Walmart.
Yeah, well, that was part of the plan. Oh, I forgot to tell you also, Project Destiny. Project Destiny, Michael Milken was involved with this, and the idea is to have pharmacists be frontline providers of health care also.
Right. Well, you see them beginning that by offering shots, vaccines.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, you're right about that. And what Milken was trying to do was to get them certified as a healthcare provider. So theoretically, you could just go into your pharmacist and say, I need an antibiotic for this or that. And, the pharmacist could look at it and say, yeah, okay, I'll give you this. But that really does bring them into the healthcare arena in a way that will enable this whole other system that I was talking about.
Right. And I would imagine that the pharmacist would get a little extra money for this service, and doesn't it get rid of the need for a doctor to prescribe anything?
Well, it does take away business from doctors. It sure does. Because if you don't have to go to a doctor to get a prescription for something, if you can just go to the pharmacist, and he and there will be insurance payments, for pharmacists that are engaged in this, that are frontline providers.
Sure.
Yeah. So really, what does that do? I mean, you've got the doctors being excluded in a way that, where they're working in teams. Can you imagine this? A team of doctors, is that a waste or what? Where they're
Yes.
supposedly consulting together, on the really tough cases.
Amazing.
And then you get the school nurse,
And of course, one of the our listeners on my RBN program is a physician, and he said that he has seen a lot of people leave the profession, and not only that, he has seen a real brain drain in the industry because people are now coming out of medical school and they only want to work 40 hours. They really don't want to have to deal with a lot of the research and all of that kind of thing. They're just ready to write out a script for a prescription, and that's about it.
And that's really the way that they're being trained. And I'll tell you what, on the nurse training, they are taking everybody and anybody into the community college system and basically providing them the kind of training that they teach them how to use a stethoscope and how to take a pulse and stuff like that, and they're giving them a certification and credits towards an RNA, a registered nurse. Well, back when I went to school, registered nurses were true professionals. They had to go all the way through school. What I'm saying is that, frankly, the people that go to community colleges, if they were of a caliber to work at a professional level job, they wouldn't be going to a community college.
Right.
Even as an adult going back to school, community colleges are really nothing more than high school,
Right.
high school beyond high school. So.
So what we're going to see, we already have a minimum of 200,000 people a year dying from medical decisions. And that's a low number, 200,000 people. With the quality of care going down, and with decisions being made by people who are not qualified to be making them, diagnoses that they are not qualified to be making, we are going to see a lot more deaths.
No question about it. I mean, I have a friend here in town who came very, very close to ending up could have been a paraplegic or quadriplegic, but she kind of she has a real heavy purse, and she swung around and, you know, threw her purse in the back seat, and she hurt her back, and she was in a lot of pain. After a couple of days, she went to the hospital, and she got a physician's assistant, and she told him what she did. She showed him that it was in the middle of her back, but what he did, he only took an X-ray of her neck and gave her some pain pills and sent her home. Well, you know, and I'd heard that she was having problems, you know, so about a week after that, I went over to see her, and she was sitting on the couch, and I watched her pick up her leg. She didn't have the muscular strength to lift up her leg. She used her arms to lift up her leg. So I told her, well, you know, get ready, because I'm going to take you to the hospital. This is ridiculous. So we went to the hospital, and I told him that she has paralysis. She's in decline. She has increasing paralysis. And, you know, 2 hours, you know, they finally ultimately decided to do one of those full body scans, an MRI.
Mm-hmm.
About 1 hour into it, the guy called me, and he said, she's going into surgery. She had a tumor on her back. And it was pushing into her spine. And about, you know, the doctor said about 1 or 2 days more, and she would have been paralyzed.
Wow. Thank goodness she's got an intuitive friend like you.
Well, I know the healthcare system. I probably know the healthcare system, you know, of all the systems that I know about, I probably know about the healthcare system the most. And so I just know how they operate. So I went with her, and I made sure that they helped her. But you know, if she'd had a real doctor to begin with, he at least would, I think, have done a better job than just a neck X-ray.
Right.
But because it was a physician's assistant, you know, he doesn't have the training. He knows he doesn't have the training, and he's afraid to stick his neck out to go for a really expensive test.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that could go as a black mark on his record if he ordered some really expensive test.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and that's the kind of situation that's being set up with this second-tier healthcare professional system.
Right.
So, I mean, it's could have been a tragedy, but I'm sure it happens every single day in this country where it is a tragedy.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. And then you have people at the motor vehicle, when you go in to get your license, ask you if you want to be an organ donor without ever explaining what that entails.
Yeah, I never signed that.
Good.
The first time I saw that, maybe I'm just a suspicious person, but first time I saw that, I thought, heck no. I'm not going to sign that so you can take my healthy organs while I'm still breathing. Come on.
Right. Which will kill you.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I've been meaning to ask you, what about the smart meter? What is the situation with the one that was put on your home?
Well, it's still there. And my option, I ran out the options. My only option was to take it to the Supreme Court of Idaho, and I fully intended to do that. But then I started thinking about it, and I decided not to do that because the way that the courts work, and especially the Supreme Court, is that once they hear a case and they make a decision, that's the ruling, that's the decision, it sets precedent. And so I decided that I didn't want my case to be the one to set precedent with me trying to play the part of attorney.
Have you ever thought of replacing that meter with an analog meter? You can do that.
No, I haven't. I haven't thought about doing that because that would be a whole other battle. I'm not sure that we would be allowed to do that, you know, and I think you'd have to fight with Idaho Power about it. And I just have other battles that I'm fighting. I'm trying to, my goal is for people to understand the technocratic system that we are all being ensnared in. And so I figured I would let somebody else fight that battle.
Okay.
And hopefully someday there'll be an attorney that, you know, has, I don't know, maybe remembers his American roots. And
wow,
maybe
that's an anomaly, an attorney.
I know. Yeah.
Although I did have a nice attorney on yesterday. There are those out there that, that you know, do seem to be concerned about sovereignty and freedom and liberties and whatnot. But I think they're few and far between. I think they're out there seeking the same profit that the rest of the corporate structure people seem to be doing.
Yeah, and that's something really important about this whole international system was that it empowered attorneys, lawyers, to participate in the cannibalization of our country and to, you know, for fun and profit, destroy the country.
Right. I mean, they're not even supposed to serve in Congress. And when you look at the composition of Congress, both the House and the Senate, you find that the majority of them are lawyers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think lawyers are, and I recognize that there are a few good ones, but they're just damn few.
Sure.
They really are parasites, and they are, because they use language and word art as their tools of their trade, they really are just con men.
Yeah, yes, they are. And they learn the rhetoric, and you know, the law, a lot of times they use Latin words from the Latin, and that makes them appear very, very smart and kind of above the rest of us. And it's very intimidating, and so people go along with this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it really is just nothing but a scam, and so is economics. I mean, economists, I trust used car salesmen more than economists,
mm-hmm.
because the vast majority of them are just nothing but con men. And that, you know, they play with statistics like lawyers play with words, economists play with statistics. And it's just nothing but a big game. You know, what can I make these people believe?
Right. So. And, of course, they're from where? The London School of Economics is basically where a lot of that dogma comes from.
Funny how that works, huh?
Yeah. Well, you know.
That's where we get our law, our economics, the education system.
Yes, yes.
And Great Britain still has that fat, I won't say it, queen over sitting on her throne. I mean, how much of a throwback is that?
Yes, yes. Well, you know, it was 1897 that the United States and Britain made a deal that they would fight together in many of the countries that they fought in thereafter, so that they would split the plunder. And note that Britain and the United States do seem to be carrying that forth even to this day.
Yeah, but it's not the United States. It's just the very few at the top who are splitting the plunder.
Right. That's what I meant. The people, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, we're kind of caught in a pincer movement. You know, we've got Canada to the north, and they were always, of course, attached to Great Britain and socialist. And then we've got Mexico to the south. They were attached to Spain and fascist. And so, you know, I really think that the two sides in the United States, the South was more allied with Great Britain, and the North, the Unionists, were more allied with down south, you know, Latin America, and you know, we're just being pulled apart.
Yep, it's certainly been interesting, and I feel that everything that we've talked about has been deliberate, has been planned way, way long time ago, and the how we're going to get out of it. You know, we always come up with all of the problems and elaborate on those, but the situation is, what can we do about it? And there are certain things that we can change in our lives. There are things that we can't change, and we just need to do the best that we can to make the choices for our own family and for ourselves so that are beneficial for us. So it's tough, and I know that there are a lot of methods that people talk about becoming a sovereign and getting, you know, withdrawing from, you know, giving back your social security card and getting out of the system. But how's that going to work when the black coats or the, you know, the people in SWAT gear are at your front door? I mean, what are you going to say? Well, I'm a citizen of the United States, and I'm not a citizen of, or, you know, what is it? I'm a citizen of the United States of America, and I'm not a citizen of the United States. Yeah, like that's really going to work? I mean, I think you can stop paying income tax. There are legitimate reasons to do that, and people should do that. And there are ways of, if you have a foreclosure that you're facing, there are ways to circumvent that and to, but it all starts with educating yourself to know what choices you do have.
Yeah, that's true. And what would really help is for people to understand how all of this is being done, which is why I do what I do. If you can't explain how something is happening, then you're not going to convince anybody. Even though we, you know, we see all of these economic developers, how we've even got departments of economic development. We have a federal economic development administration. In our local town, we have an economic development agency. But, you know, if people don't understand what that is and how this whole system is operating, then they really have no idea where to begin to turn it around. So that's, and because I know that this is a technocratic system, all of these people are systems analysts. The people that are doing the designs of all this, they're all systems analysts, and they are designing these systems of subversion. And they're cannibalizing our local representative government. And so, and they're the way that the system works is through associations. The United Nations is an association. It works with associations. Your city and state officials belong to associations. They're city and st their associations within the state connect to national, connect to international. And so what you have is like a parallel subversive structure. going on. And so while while most people are all busy watching the political Punch and Judy show and their politicians, you've got this subversive thread that is behind the curtain of administrative government. And they're really the ones that are implementing this whole international agenda.
Sure. And it's always been that way. There's always been that select few who are calling the shots, and they unite together with like-minded people, whether they're psychopathic or whatever, and I'm certain that some of them are, most of them are. They have always united people. They find each other, and then they sit in their boardrooms and decide what they're going to do with the rest of us and how they are going to structure our lives, how they're going to educate us, how they are going to mismanage us by introducing all kinds of perverse behaviors into the population to destroy family life and every other thing. So it is designed. They have designed this. It isn't just happenstance. It isn't just that, oh, we're just, look at what's happening to the country. It's, you know, it's this or it's that. No, it's deliberate, and it was planned decades ago.
Right. Well, I mean, that multiculturalism is a classic example. You know, we are supposed to all be working and living in harmony. You know, my neighbor is my brother, and we're all working on this. Well, you know, I just have nothing in common with Muslims. I have nothing in common with Jews. I have nothing in common with the Mexican culture. I have nothing in common with the Chinese culture. I have nothing in common with the African culture. So, you know, when you import all of these people into this country, you can't possibly expect a harmonious environment. And so that, again, belies it's the fraud of the whole multicultural doctrine.
Right. And certainly that has been going on for decades. I mean, it started probably in 1880 with people who thought this is the melting pot. I mean, that's what it was called. And there was a person that actually wrote a play called The Melting Pot. And it just, you know, it was produced and promoted to make us think, oh, yes, we've got to accept all of these third world people coming into our country. But even at that time, the immigration was set up so that there were certain limits on the number of people who could come into the country, and they had to have a certain number of people from that country already here. And then when you get down to about 1924, they changed the immigration laws so that we were accepting people from third world countries, people that we didn't have much in common with. These people just came in, and many of them were from socialistic countries, and they brought those kinds of philosophies with them. And I mean, if you look at the Lady Liberty with the poem of welcome to the immigrants, and a portion of that poem states, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." Well, we don't want a bunch of homeless, broke people. At least the country, you know, before this occurred, before they changed the immigration policies, there were people who wanted to come over. They were looking for freedom. They were looking to work, to take care of themselves. They had independence. They were not dependent on handout from the government. And so you had a whole a change of mentality in about 1882, where you had all these hordes that had immigrated from the Russian Pale to New York. And pretty soon things changed drastically. And then you had a lot of people coming in who committed a lot of crimes. And, you know, the same kinds of crimes that they committed in their home country. If somebody didn't pay a protection fee, you just slashed their throat. Well, gosh, that wasn't the kind of people who originally settled this country. We had good German people, Irish people, Scots people. And if you look at the census records and the immigration records from 1820, which is when they started keeping them, you note that people were coming from certain countries and that they had an interest in the country that they were coming to contribute, not to extract the resources. But to increase the resources, to increase their own resources, to take care of themselves, to farm the land.
Well, yeah, and what they did, they allowed so many in that they diluted our culture, and the other people didn't assimilate. If you allow too many in, of course, they don't assimilate. They just kind of bunch up in their little herd. I mean, that's balkanization. And Mexicans, they allowed so many in that the Mexicans, of course, brought their culture. And apparently, I didn't know this, but apparently, the poor people in Mexico, they have to pay a bribe to the boss, for the job.
Right, and legitimately, there should be no poor people in Mexico because they have a resource-rich country, and it was the fall of the peso when in 1994 that drove so many people into desperate straits in Mexico, and the peso fell to the point that it was worth hardly anything, and this was orchestrated also in order. People don't move from their home country because of a just out of the clear blue, there's usually a reason. Like the Irish didn't leave Ireland until there was a famine, and then they had it all fixed up where they could give passage to all these Irishmen because they needed cheap labor in Manhattan. And so Rothschild got together with some of his cronies and decided to do this humanitarian gesture and allow these people to go work in Manhattan for $1 a day. And heck, if they lost their arm in one of the machines or something, they were tossed out on the street. So,
Well,
it's a product, it's a cheap labor situation. You create a famine in one place or economic deprivation in one place. To move people to another place where you can exploit the labor.
yeah, it's all about exploitation, and that's the way that the economic development system works, is they just flood an area with money and they buy off the local officials. They make it seem like there's an economic boom, but what they're actually doing is creating debt. Only certain people make a lot of money, but for the infrastructure and for other things that have gone on, it's the local people are left with the debt, while the profits are exported once the tide turns.
Sure.
It, you know, yesterday, Alex Jones played on his program that speech by Ned Beatty, did the speech in the movie Network.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and that speech is so powerful and so true. It's about the ebb and flow. And, as the money washes in, there it's really just a setup to get things going, and what comes after that is the massive extraction.
Right. And
And
that's what it's all about. If you get right down to it, it's all about the money. Yeah.
Yeah, and they in order to grow, everything is about growth, growth, growth. Well, they bring in new populations of people because it's not just the cheap labor, but those people have to have houses. They have to have all of the accoutrements of living in the United States. And so they are using excess populations to show growth in for the United States economy. But it's only growth in one area, and it's decline throughout the rest of the economy.
Right.
Yeah,
And go ahead.
if you notice, when they talk about startup firms, they always say that gee, most new companies are started up by foreigners. Well, the reason why, of course, is because the whole infrastructure of the government creating jobs is designed for minorities, and of course, foreign imports are always minorities, right?
Yes. Oh, those people in Washington are treasonous.
Yeah,
son
that's
of guns.
That's
really
that's
are.
What I mean by institutionalized treachery.
Yes. Indeed. Well, it has been absolutely wonderful talking with you.
Well, I've enjoyed it too. I mean, I don't very often get to do these kinds of free flow things, and I know we started out to talk about the Marshall Plan in Latin America, but what all of these things, they're all tied together, and they're all what is bringing the country, our country, down.
Right.
And it will decline. It will continue to decline. I don't know that there will ever be a day, you know, when like Mount Vesuvius blew, you know, the everything crashes in the United States. It's not going to be that way. It's just going to be a slow and steady decline to the third world.
Right. Yes. And I think you can see that, at least in my area, where the infrastructure is kind of falling apart. The roads are kind of, they're wearing out. And and of course, a lot of the things have been sold to private companies, such as the parking meters in Chicago and the roadways in Chicago. They are all now being, they were leased, I believe, for 75 years to a foreign company. And, you know, they're not interested in upkeep. They're just interested in collecting the tolls.
Right. It's all part of the privatization of government,
right,
which means the elimination of government, because they have a regional super governing structure. And so the privatization of government is just the collapse of your government. You know?
Right. And of course, everybody thinks that this, well, not everybody, but people, if you talk to them about the privatization and say, oh, we should let a private company take over for, say, the post office or whatever, that people say, oh, yes, and we can get better service, because we all know that the government stinks. But that's deliberate. That's deliberate mediocrity.
Well, that's somebody who doesn't understand organizations.
Right.
Because there is no difference between the bureaucracy of a large multinational corporation and the bureaucracy of government. A bureaucracy is a bureaucracy is a bureaucracy. And so
five times.
Yeah. The real difference is that a corporate bureaucracy is in business to make money.
Right.
And they love your essential services.
Right.
Because they can extract more money.
And they don't have any oversight. There's no oversight.
Yeah. And so, you know, with a government, they are nonprofit. Theoretically, they are supposed to work in everybody's interests.
Right.
And you know what? I long for the days of incompetent government. I mean, they're still incompetent because they're still incompetent. But you know, if we could just go back to when it really was a government rather than just the dying corpse that is morphing into a fascist police state.
Right.
You know, people will rue the day when they wanted a government that operated more like a corporation.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Because they're going to be slaves.
Yes, we are. Mm-hmm. All righty. Well, thank you so very much. And
okay.
Again, your website is channelingreality.com. Our guest today has been Vicki Davis, and it's been very nice talking with you.
Thank you, Deanna.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.